Parashat Kisavo opens with the subject of Bikurim. And as we will see, there's quite a number of psukim. It's really most of Rishon, a good dozen or so psukim. And the Alshich HaKadosh takes us through the psukim and raises, as is his way, a number of fine questions. If there seems to be repetition, if there seems to be fluctuation in phraseology, the Alshich will note it, and what comes out will be something very rewarding. Firstly, opening pasuk, Vayaki Sabol El Haaretz. It will be when you come to the land, Asher Hashem Elokecha Nosein Lecha Nachala, that Hashem is giving you as an inheritance, V'yishta V'yoshav Taba, and you will inherit it and settle in it. Well, the first thing to note is that having already stated or described the land as a place that Hashem is giving us as an inheritance, Nosein Lecha Nachala, what then is added by the final phrase, Virishta, and you will inherit it. Anything that's given to you as an inheritance, so then you inherit. Those words seemingly are redundant. Furthermore, Pasuk Beis describes taking the first fruit, the Bikurim, and what do you do, where do you go, and what do you say? Pasuk Gimel, Uvaso ala kohen, asher yeh bayamim mahem. You come to the Kohen, that is to say, you come to the Beis HaMikdash, the Omar Ta'ilav, and you say as follows, Higadati, I stated, Hayom, Hashem Elokecha, to Hashem, your God, Kivasi ala Aretz, Asher Nishba, Hashem Labroseinu, Laseis Lanu, that I've come to the land that Hashem, our God, swore to give to us. Here too, a couple of basic questions. Firstly, the person says, Higadati Hayom, I stated that I have come to the land. But nowhere do we find, prior to this, that he actually states this. He turns up and says, he says that he said it, but where did he say it? Unless you say that he's saying it now. Some explain that way. Higadati, I am hereby declaring. But the simple translation of Higadati sounds like I've said it already. But where? How come we weren't told about it? Secondly, in this pasuk, which is also noteworthy, is the way that Hashem himself is referred to. In the beginning of the pasuk, or in the beginning of this person's declaration, it says, Higadati hayom l'Hashem Elokecha. I stated today to Hashem, your God, which is unusual, because you're in the Beis HaMikdash, and you're Jewish, and he's Jewish, and Hashem is the God of both of you. What then does he mean by referring to Hashem as Hashem Elokecha? Especially as he goes on to say, Kivasi al aretz Hashem nishba Hashem Elokecha or Elokeinu, but that's difficult. Hashem Elokecha. The Kohen will be pleased to hear, but why is he leaving himself out, so to speak? He's in the middle of doing a mitzvah. In Pasuk Dalet, it states, V'lokacha kohen atene miyodecha. The Kohen takes the basket from your hand, V'hinicho lefnei mizbeach Hashem Elokecha, and he places it before the mizbeach. Now, interestingly, the Bikurim will be placed down a second time, or set down a second time. That's described in Pasuk Yud. Pasuk Yud reads, Vata, Hinei Hevesi, Es Reshis Pri Adama Shenosata Li Hashem, I've brought the fruits. V'hinachto, the Torah says, talking to this person, addressing you, the Bikurim bringer. V'hinachto, and you shall place it, Lifnei Hashem Elokecha. So the question is, why is it that initially it's the Kohen, the Kohen, who places the Bikurim down, and subsequently it's you? Also interesting is, back to Pasuk Dalet, again, trying to note all of these details, and when it says that the Kohen places the Bikurim, it says where? V'hinicho lifnei mizbach Hashem Elokecha. He shall set the Bikurim down before the Mizbeach. In Pasuk Yud, it says, V'hinachto, coming back to when it tells you to place the Bikurim, V'hinachto lefnei Hashem Elokecha, place them before Hashem. Where is that? Apparently anywhere. Maybe it's the same place, maybe it's near the Mizbeach. The Pasuk doesn't say. And therefore the question has become fine-tuned. The Bikurim are placed down twice. The first time it's by the Kohen, and the Torah specifies where, next to the Mizbeach. The second time it's by you, and the Torah doesn't specify where. Wherever you set it down, apparently, is fine. It's all before Hashem. And finally, I guess something that we take for granted, which is the intervening psukim, the famous declaration that one makes when bringing Bikurim, what's known as Mikra Bikurim Aramiya Vedavi, which we, of course, know in much more greater detail from Seder night, but originally it's from the mitzvah of bringing Bikurim. And you start from the beginning, Aramiya Vedavi, and then we went to Mitzrayim, and then we cried out to Hashem, and he took us out, and he brought us here. It's a lot of history. One could say that history, that preamble, is the prelude to many mitzvahs. Aramiya Vedavi, Vayered Mitzrayim, we went down, we came out, and here I am, and I'm doing a mitzvah. But the Torah insists that the person say as he brings Bikurim. The question is, what are we to make of all of this? Do not be disappointed if I tell you that these are not all of the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh questions. They are a sampling of his questions. If we quoted all of his questions, the shiur would be over before we got to the answer. But the Al-Sheikh explains, what is the theme of Bikurim? Not difficult to surmise and appreciate that the theme of Bikurim is that of Hakaras HaTov, of appreciation, of recognition, of gratitude for Hashem for bringing us to Eretz Yisrael. However, there is a problem. One could almost call it a territorial hazard that comes with us being in Eretz Yisrael. And that is our appreciation can sometimes risk being compromised or lessened. Lessened by a feeling of entitlement. As if to say, perhaps there are various reasons we deserve to be in Eretz Yisrael beyond the fact that Hashem has given it to us. And the more we feel entitled to be here, the less we express appreciation to Hashem for allowing us to be here. And that really is what Bikurim is all about. But where would this feeling of entitlement come from? I mean, the Eretz Yisrael is the land of the Jewish people. He gave it to us. Where does it perhaps take a wrong turn? The answer, says the Al-Sheikh, is we need to be sure that we do not abuse the concept of Hashem promising the land to Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, which he did on a number of occasions, because the abuse of that idea would take the form of saying, you know, Hashem promised the land to the Avos, so of course to them it was a great kindness, but that's done, and here we are, and he's keeping his promise, but that's a promise made to them. So we're born into it. So presumably they should thank him, and we assume they did, but that's between him and them. We're just descended from them. We have good yichus. That's life. And that lessens, in a sense, the full meaning of what it means for us to be in Eretz Yisrael, because there is no longer any direct connection between Hashem, us, and the land. The connection is really between Hashem and our ancestors and the land, and we just happen to be descended from them. So we have no current sense of connectivity. And all of this is included, says the Al-Sheikh, in the opening pasuk of the Perek. If we read carefully, as we noted, the pasuk seems to say the same thing twice. Again, the words, V'haya ki sabo al aretz, Asher Hashem Elokecha, nosin lecha nachala, when you come to the land that Hashem is giving you as an inheritance, V'rishdav yashavta ba, and you will inherit. Actually, says the Al-Sheikh, these two phrases are two approaches to being an Eretz Yisrael. One of them is correct and the other is flawed. One of them is the actual approach, and the other is the one that we may tend to have. It's interesting that the idea of nosein, which is a gift, and nachala, which is an inheritance, is actually almost an antithetical one to the other, because if it's an inheritance, then you inherit. If it's a gift, you receive. So there's an interesting blend. The way the Torah presents the situation, Hashem is actually giving it to you as a nachala, as if to say, if it was pure nachala, you might not get it. But you do. But Hashem is giving it to you. Don't lose sight of the fact that that you are receiving something from Hashem. That first phrase is the reality. But the final phrase is a description of how the Jewish people or the Jew may take it in the course of time. Because the pasuk concludes by saying, Virishta, you'll inherit. It began by saying two things. It's a gift of inheritance. But it ended with just one thing. You inherit. It didn't say you receive. And here the Torah is introducing the danger that we may not be conscious of the fact that we're receiving anything. We're simply inheriting. And again, the reason why is because Hashem made the oath to our forefathers, and that's history, and it's got nothing to do with us. There's no giving and receiving on our part. And it's to this end the Torah says there is a mitzvah called Bikurim. And Bikurim is a yearly reminder. It could be throughout the course of the year we drift or we lose focus on this idea. And Bikurim brings it back into sharp focus. And therefore Bikurim actually begins with something of a confession. And that's what happens in Pasuk Gimel, where it states, Uvaso el kohen, come to the Kohen, Asher Yebayimimahem. Va'amartah, you say to him, I'm here to correct something. I'm here to correct the difference between what I was saying and what I should be saying. What was I saying? Higadati. Higadati hayom. Meaning even today, prior to coming here, this was perhaps my attitude. What was I saying? How was I relating to the land? Lashem elokecha. Kivasi ala aretz. I've come to the land. Hashem swore to give it to us. He swore to them, and he kept his oath, which is very nice. But he didn't swear to us. He didn't give it to us. It's between him and them. And that's the flawed approach. And in recognition of that, of disconnecting ourselves from receiving something from Hashem directly, he refers to Hashem, when he speaks to the Kohen, he refers to Hashem as Hashem Elokecha. Hashem, your God, as if to say that he has actually distanced himself from Hashem in this respect. If you distance yourself from the gift that Hashem gives you, you distance yourself from him. Which means currently, in that earlier mindset, the flawed mindset, only one of them is really connected to Hashem, the Kohen, and not the one bringing Bikurim. But he's coming to redress that. He's coming to right that wrong. And therefore, he gives the Bikurim to the Kohen. And at this stage, actually, he cannot even represent himself before Hashem. It's the Kohen who places the Bikurim down before Hashem. Because the Kohen is currently the only one who's really connected. And moreover, you give it to the Kohen, that's the most you can do. The Kohen puts it down, and the Torah emphasizes, the Torah puts it down in front of the Mizbeach, or next to the Mizbeach. Eitz HaMizbeach Hashem Elokecha. Why is it emphasizing? Because what is the Mizbeach? And what does the Mizbeach do? The Mizbeach is there for korbanos. Now, Bikurim do not seem to be a type of a korban, but in a sense they are. And there are actually halachas of korbanos that apply to Bikurim. And the reason why they're a korban is because they have something in common. They are there to attain kapara, like a korban. Kapara for what? For failing to recognize the gift of Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, in that earlier mindset, the person needs the Kohen to achieve kapara for him. And therefore, the Torah says the Kohen puts it down and tells us where he puts it down. Now the question is, wherein lies the mistake? After all, is it not true? Apparently not, but why not? Hashem swore to the fathers, and we're descended from them, and therefore we're collecting as heirs, but not as recipients. Why is that not true? The reason why it's not true is the subject of the intervening psukim or the intermittent psukim of Arami Avedavi. That's why we go through the history now. Because by the time you finish going through the history, you'll understand that us receiving Eretz Yisrael from Hashem is not to be taken for granted. And here is why. The original bris that was made between Hashem and Avram, which is where it all started, the bris ben HaBesarim, and there it said quite clearly that Ger Yazarecha, Be'eretz Elohem, Ba'avodum, Ve'inuosam, Arba Me'oshana, that the term of the bris ben HaBesarim is 400 years. Now, as we know, we were not in Mitzrayim for 400 years. We were there for 210 years. Something happened. And there's many approaches as to what to make of it. But there is a major school within Chazal themselves who understand very simply that we didn't go the distance. No, we couldn't. We had to be taken out in the middle. Now, if that's so, then there is fallout from that. There are consequences of that. Because the follow-up from the Bris Ben HaBesarim is to come back to Eretz Yisrael. V'doru v'i yoshuvu heino. That part of the Bris Ben HaBesarim is the land of Hashem, Avram, Bris, Lazarach, Etin, Esaret. But that Bris is also part of Vavodim v'inu, Asim, Avram, Me'oshana. If that's the case, then there's room to say that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, does not need to follow up on his oath to Avram Avinu to give us Eretz Yisrael, because it was made contingent upon 400 years in Mitzrayim. Now, he did anyway, but that has to be reappraised and reappreciated. And therefore we say, if we have a look at the Psukim, what do we emphasize? It's interesting to see the phrases of Arami Avedavi together when we normally prize them apart. Pasuk Hey, Va'anisa Va'amata Lefnei Hashem Elokecha, Arami Avedavi, Vayered Mitzrayma, so we went out to Mitzrayim. Pasuk Vav, Vayereyu Asana Mitzrayim, they were bad to us. Vayanunu, they afflicted us. Vayetnu Aleinu Avoda Kosha. And Pasuk Zayin, Vanitzak El Hashem Elokei Avoseinu. We cried out to Hashem, Vayishma Hashem Eskoleinu. From a certain point of view, this pasuk, which is at the center, which really, there's only four or five psukim in the whole thing, but it really emphasizes the role of prayer here, or more correctly, that we were crying out to Hashem, and Hashem heard our voice. Now there's a major question with regards to Yetzias Mitzrayim, namely, why did we need to daven? Maybe we didn't need to, we did anyway. But what if we wouldn't have davened? What if we wouldn't have cried out? We would have stayed there? After all, what about the deal? What about the covenant? So the Alshul says, the covenant says 400 years. You're just over halfway through. So in pure terms, Hashem doesn't need to follow up on the covenant, but he took you out anyway. And the reason why he took us out is because we cried out and Hashem heard our voice and intervened. And really, therefore, Pasuk Zayin and Pasuk Ches, which say we cried out to Hashem, he heard our voice and took us out, meaning that even though the time had not elapsed, and we had not gone the full duration of 400 years, Hashem took us out anyway because we cried out. But that has repercussions now for the fact that he brought us to the land. Because now, if he brings us to the land, but we didn't go the 400 years, so there is no requirement, so to speak, in terms of the bris he made with Avram or the shvui that he made with Avram. And he brought us here anyway. And that is what Bikurim is bringing the person to recognize. We cannot feel entitled in the sense that Hashem had to honor his vow, his oath, so to speak, to the Avos, and we are descended from them. The terms of that oath were not fulfilled, and Hashem brought us here anyway. That needs to be appreciated, both in terms of the basic moral requirement to appreciate it, and also to have a sense of the way we should conduct ourselves, given the fact that we've received the land of Israel as a gift directly from Hashem. So this, amazingly, these psukim of Arami Avedavi, they are corrective history. As if to say, if you look back, you'll realize that perhaps the way we related to our presence in the land was presumptuous and not correct. The question is, now what? The person, he's almost like a new man after he's been through this story and gotten his history straight. Pasuk Yud states, and now, meaning, based on all of this, I brought the first fruits. Of course, only natural, an expression of gratitude. I brought the first fruits of the land. Hashem, that you, Hashem, have given me. It's a breakthrough. It's a new paradigm. He no longer is saying that I've come to the land that Hashem swore to my forefathers. The forefathers are not mentioned anymore. I'm here. Why am I here? Hashem gave me the land. I'm here to say thank you. So the Torah says, you've made it this far. Good for you. You know what? The Bikurim should be set down again. But you can set them down because you're back in. You've reconnected. You appreciate your connection with Hashem in having given you Eretz Yisrael. So then you don't need the Kohen to put the Bikurim down for you anymore. You can put them down. And moreover, the Pasuk doesn't specify that you put them next to the Mizbeah. Because the second time, by this stage, you've got it right. They only needed to be placed by the Mizbeah the first time when you were trying to correct a wrong. But having corrected that, place them down as an act of gratitude. But it doesn't need to be near the Mizbeah. Because you don't need Kapara anymore. You've rectified through getting the facts straight from the passage of Aramia Vidavi. So this is a truly, it's a sweeping peirush, as the Al-Sheikh in his way goes through so many questions which are addressed, and a truly wonderful and very thought-provoking, actually, statement about our own relationship with Eretz Yisrael, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through Eretz Yisrael. It's not just history. It's constantly history in the making. I'd like to move from here to a section which is a little bit further into the parasha, in the beginning of Perek Kaf Zayin. And Perek Kaf Zayin discusses the writing of the Torah on certain stones that as we come into Eretz Yisrael. And as the Pasuk says, in Pasuk Beis, Perek Kaf Zayin, Pasuk Beis, on the day that you cross the Yarden, no stain lach that Hashem is giving you. You should set up these huge stones, should coat them with limestone. The is called Divri HaTorah Hazos, Pasuk Gimel, Barecha, and write down all of the Torah. That's the special mitzvah, as the Abba Benel refers to these stones as the mezuzah of Eretz Yisrael. It's a country. It's somewhat more than the parchment, but the same concept. And interestingly, there is a dispute among the Chachamim, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Huda, as to how to understand exactly the sequence of the writing of these stones. Writing on these stones, that is to say. The order of the psukim, because there are two aspects here. There's coating them with a limestone, and then there's writing on them. Which comes first? First you write and then you coat, or first you coat and then you write? Well, the order of the pasuk actually mentions first v'sadata osam basid, in the end of pasuk base. First they're coated. Then pasuk gimel says to write the words of the Torah. And indeed, that is the opinion of Rabbi Shimon, and it's straightforward, and it's sequential, and that's his opinion. However, Rabbi Huda is of the opinion, this is the Gemara in Sota, Daf Lamed Hei, that actually, first, they wrote, and then they covered the writing. First came the Ksiva, and then Vesadata Osam Basid. Well, that machlokus stands, and it's very interesting that although this is a historical mitzvah and it's not an ongoing mitzvah, it could potentially have ramifications for a shaila which was asked much, much later on. Rav Meir Eisenstadt, one of the great poskim of the 1700s in the Shelos Tshuvos, Ponim Me'iros, was asked an interesting shaila. A shul was being repainted, which so far that sounds like a good thing. The thing is, however, that we have a minhag whereby certain passages are suspended. They're on the wall in the sense that they're on posters or plaques which are suspended from the wall. It could be modim derabbanan, whatever it may be. Back in the day, when they were not as sophisticated, whatever they wanted to be on the wall was written directly on the wall. And one of the things that they would write directly on the wall was the Yud Gimel Midrash Harachamim. So they would write, Hashem, Hashem, Karacha V'Chanan. I mean, when they say the writing is on the wall, in this case, it was quite literally, that's where they put it. Now, and they would write it, Mamash, the Shem Havaya, Yud Kei Vavkei. So now the question is, they're looking to repaint. But repaint means completely. So the question is, are they allowed to paint over everything that they'd written, which will include Shem Hashem? That was the question which was asked to the Panim Meiros. Now, interestingly, we're not going to go into the entire tshuva of the Panim Meiros, but part of it, it says, Rameir Eisenstadt, there's room to say that one could adduce a proof that it's permissible. Because really the question is, what is the worry erasing Shem Hashem? Because you're painting over it. So now the question is, if you paint over something, if you color over something, is that called erasing? Perhaps one could argue that erasing is removal of the letter, rubbing it out. There's nothing there anymore. Here, it stays where it was. It's just covered by something else. It's currently inaccessible and maybe permanently inaccessible. That may well be, but it's still there. So that's the question. It's almost a philosophical question. I mean, if something that's covered over and beyond access, is it as if it's been removed completely? That's the question. Because when they paint over it, it's fafala. That's the end. You're not going to see it again. Because if you remove the paint, you could remove some of the ink also. So that's the end of that. Says the Panim Meiros. It's interesting to note that back to the discussion between Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Huda about these stones. What came first? The writing first or the coating? Well, that's a machlokas. Rabbi Shimon says it's the order of the pasuk. First they coated and then they wrote on the limestone. That's what it means according to Rabbi Shimon. But according to Rabbi Huda, first they wrote on the stone and then they covered it over. But isn't that exactly what we're talking about, says Panim Meiros? Doesn't that mean that there was writing there and then they covered it over with another layer and then it's inaccessible? So that would seem to be a proof that it's mutter. No one objected on religious grounds to what Rabbi Huda is talking about, that you're erasing, you know, shamos, etc. Now, many, many people get involved in this question, as you can imagine. There's many angles. But among them, firstly, after all, the critical issue is erasing Shem Hashem. And we assume that if you've written the whole Torah, you've also written Shem Hashem. But the first question that we need to address in terms of whether this is actually approved is what was written on those stones. And here we already have something of a difference of opinion. Whereas there are those who say quite clearly that when it says you write the whole Torah, it means from Bereishis till the end. Chamisha Chumshei Torah. Completely. That is the opinion of the Ramban. Okay, if that's so, that includes Shem Hashem as written. However, there are those who quote Rabbeinu Sadyagon, who states, and there are logistical issues after all, if you've got 12 stones and you've got to write the whole Torah, especially as they ended up writing it 70 times, that's a lot for 12 stones. Okay, so be it. But Rabbeinu Sadyagon says that when it says they wrote the whole Torah on these 12 stones, it doesn't mean they wrote the text of the Chumash, but rather it means they wrote the contents of the Torah, as if to say, the Tariq Mitzvahs, the 613 Mitzvahs. And the 613 Mitzvahs can be written in a way which doesn't have the name of Yud Kei Vav Kei. As if to say, if we wish to adduce proof from these stones that you can paint over Shem Hashem, you have to assume that Shem Hashem was on the stones. Otherwise it's no raya, because the central problem is maybe it wasn't there. According to Rabbeinu Sadyagon, it was a list of mitzvahs, but it wasn't the text of the Chumash. That's number one. The second interesting issue is raised by Rabbi Kiva Eger. And that is, firstly, in what language was the Torah written on these 12 stones? Now, the background to the question is, in the end of Pasuk Ches, it says, or Pasuk Ches states, the Kosavto al ha'avanim, es kol devei ha'Torah zos, ba'er heitev. You should write on these 12 stones all the words of the Torah, ba'er heitev. Explained very well. How well is very well? What does that mean? Rashi comments, his sources from Chazal. Ba'eretev means b'shivim loshon, in the 70 languages. Which means that whatever was written on these 12 stones was written in 70 languages. And now the follow-up question is Hebrew one of the 70 languages? Or is it maybe number 71? Or more correctly, number 1? And Rabbi Akiva Eiger adduces various proofs that Hebrew is not one of the 70. They're just like the 70 nations plus the Jewish people, the 70 languages plus Lashon HaKodesh. And the point is, therefore, that it could be that all of the writing on these stones, none of it was in Hebrew. And this brings us to a very interesting question. And that is, what is the status of erasing Hashem's name if it is written in a language other than Hebrew? Is it still the Torah prohibition of erasing Hashem's name? And here we come to a very well-known dispute. According to the Shach, or Shabsa Cohen, there is no prohibition. Others argue. And therefore, once again, says Rabbi Akiva Eiger, if we're looking to adduce proof from the stones that you can paint over Shem Hashem, you can only adduce proof if the Shem Hashem on the stones was in Hebrew, was in Lashon HaKodesh, Yud Kei Vav Kei, because then there's the Torah prohibition, and you can say the painting over is not called erasing. But if it was in every other language aside from Hebrew, then there is no proof, because it could be that there is no Torah prohibition for erasing those names. That's the opinion of the Shach. Well, finally, another of the great Sifrei Shelos HaTshuvos, Me'il Tzedakah, Rabbi Yonah Lansdorf, he has a different approach altogether, which again will moot the proof. Namely, when the Torah says that whatever was written was to be written on the stones, how is it to be written on the stones? What springs to mind if you imagine the Jewish people writing on the stone? They took a quill and ink and wrote on stones? Possibly. But it's also true that, generally speaking, when something is written on stone, the way to write on stone is in stone. That is to say, it's etched in stone. It's carved out. And the Me'il Tzedakah understands that that was the form of the writing on the stone. It actually took the form of engraving. And the reason why that makes a difference is because if you write in ink and then you cover it over, when you remove the covering, it could be the ink will come away. But if you engrave into stone and then you cover it over, if you remove the covering, the engraving is still there, which means here this covering is not the same as painting over ink, because if you paint over ink, the two are forever bound up, it's lost. But if you coat to something that's engraved, it's never lost. Remove the coating, the engraving is still there, and therefore it could be that that's why there was no problem of mochek, of erasing Shem Hashem. So as we see, there's a great deal to talk about, and each discussion becomes its own discussion then for its halachic ramifications. I'd just like to conclude. We've spoken a little bit in halacha. Our job is not to pask in the halacha, but just to see how something from that one specific time yet continues to have repercussions and potential ramifications for much more later questions. But I would like just to add one comment about the machlokas itself, Rabbi Shimon and Rabbi Yehuda. Again, to reiterate, first mentions covering them with limestone, then writing. What was the order? According to Rabbi Shimon, that was the order. First they covered, then they wrote, as the pasuk says. According to Rabbi Yehuda, no, first they wrote and then they covered. Even though the pasuk says it the other way around, one will have to invoke after a fashion the idea of Ein muktam u'mu'ucha b'Torah, what was written first happened second, and that can happen, and apparently that's what happens. But I would like, perhaps, I haven't seen anyone who says this, but I think there's room to say this, that actually the if we look at the psukim carefully, they support Rabbi Yehuda's position, even though he says they were out of order. How so? Let's read again Pasuk Beis. V'haya b'yom Hashem asher tarvu es hayadein, el ha'aretz asher Hashem lokecha nosei lach. On the day you cross the Yarden, to the land Hashem is giving you, you'll set up these great big stones and cover them with limestone. Next pasuk, first mention is the covering, the coating, and then pasuk gimel v'chasavta alehem. Then you write, quite so. Here's my question. The word even is a feminine noun. And although we say Evan and Avanim, but it is feminine. Evan Shelema. and Evan Gedola and Avonim Gedolos, as indeed the Pasuk says, Vakemos Elacha, Avonim Gedolos. That's correct. But then it says, Vesadata Osam Basid, you shall coat them. The problem, of course, is it should not have said Osam with a mem because they are Avonim Gedolos. It should have said Vesadata Osan with a nun. The nun is the correct suffix letter. As indeed, the next pasuk says, V'chosavta alehen, with a nun, not with a mem. So to summarize, we're trying to keep an eye on the grammar here, trying to keep things in order, but we've gone from feminine to masculine to feminine. And we need to ponder why. And I believe one may suggest as follows. We have mentioned on a number of occasions the idea that sometimes words in Lashon HaKodesh, they're composite words, they're hybrid words, as if to say there is what you'd expect, but sometimes the Torah attaches something that you wouldn't expect in order to alert you to an additional element within that word. That sounds a little bit abstract. I'll give you our favored example with regards to this. When Moshe runs away to Midian and he goes to the well, he meets Yisro's daughters, and Yisro's daughters are being harassed by the shepherds, and the pasuk says, "Vayavo haroim vayigarshum." The shepherds came and tried to get rid of Yisro's daughters. Moshe stands up for them, he saves them, and that was the beginning of the rest is history. Now the pasuk says, again with regards to Yisro's daughters, "Vayavo haroim vayigarshum," with a mem. The final men, the shepherds came and tried to shoo them away, to get rid of them. The problem is, they're all Yisro's daughters. And because they're all his daughters, so the suffix letter should have been a nun. I mean, they shouldn't have done it in the first place, but if they're doing it, at least say it grammatically correctly. Vayavo haroim vayigarshun, should have said. Says the Ksav Kabbalah, the Torah doesn't use the quote-unquote correct, all things being equal form. And the reason why is because the Torah wishes to tell us that there's more to this situation than just a description of an event. What's the background to the event? Why are they being harassed by these shepherds? Well, we know. They didn't ever do anything to anyone. But Yisro did. Yisro put everyone in Midian in a bad mood because he was there singing, which is guaranteed to create a sour atmosphere in a pagan village. And therefore, he was persona non grata, and so were his family. But you see, says the Ksav Kabbalah, that's why when the shepherds came and harassed them, it says, Vayavo haroim vayigarshum. It gives it a masculine suffix, because there's a masculine element here. Because the truth is that as much as they were the ones who were the victims here, but it wasn't about them. It wasn't due to them. They never did anything wrong. The grievance was not with them, it was with Yisro. And that's communicated by this composite word, where we're talking about them, but there's this element of Yisro there as well, because it was really about him. And that is a fascinating idea in itself. Milim murkavot, hybrid words or composite words, the way the Torah puts them together. How does this relate to us in our situation? Well, avonim is a feminine word, quite so. But sometimes the Torah will choose to refer to something not necessarily in terms of its raw material, but in terms of what has become of it. And what that means is there's a difference between a stone with writing on it, that is to say, with the Torah written on it, and a stone without the Torah written on it. A stone without the Torah written on it is a stone. A stone with the Torah written on it is a sefer. It's a sefer Torah. As surely as a klaf, parchment without the Torah written on it, is parchment. And with the Torah, no one calls it parchment anymore. What's it called? A sefer Torah. The parchment didn't change, but it's attained a new quality now. And it's no longer parchment. Now it's a sefer. A stone with the Torah written on it is a sefer. And the sefer is a masculine verb. Now, and therefore, the Torah says, "Vakemosa lacha avonim gedolos." Set up these big stones, and it uses the feminine because when you set them up, they're just stones. But then it does two things to do: to coat them in lime, and then to write the Torah on them. And the question is, which one comes first? Now, the order is the way it is. But according to Rabbi Huda, they were written on first and then coated. And how do we know that? Because even though the coating is mentioned second, but it says, v'sadata osam lasid, lashon zachar, in the masculine, as if to say, by the time you come to coat them, they are already a sefer because the Torah has been written on them. And that's why the next pasuk says, v'chosavta aleihen, because when you write on them, they're just stones. By the time you cover them, they're already a sefer. And thus you go from Avonim Gedolos to Besadata of Sum to Bechasavta Alehen. So this, I suggest, as a support, so to speak, for the opinion of Rabbi Huda from within the Psukim themselves. Okay. Well, we come now to... for us, it's the final segment, but it takes most of the parsha, which is the Tochacha. And this is the second Tochacha, as we know. And a lot is discussed in terms of differences between the first Tochacha, which is in the end of Chumash Vayikra, that is to say, Parshas Bechukosai, and the Tochacha here. Foremost among them, is that it shifts again from Lashon Rabim to Lashon Yachid, from the plural to the singular. In Bechukosai is all in the plural. Bechukosai Teilechu, Bechukosai Tim Asu, Vimno Tishme Uli, Behebesi Aleichem. It's all in the plural, whereas the Tochachoid is all in the singular. And there are a number of reasons as to why that is. The Kli Yakar says, interestingly, that something changes between the two, and this is the Gemara itself talks about. As we're about to enter Eretz Yisrael, there's a new idea, which is called Kol Yisrael Arevim Zelazeh. That the Jewish people become responsible one for the other. The definition of success is no longer contained within each person for themselves, but rather success is when I'm okay and everyone that I can help is also okay, to the extent that I can be of some type of assistance. It's my problem as well if someone else has a problem. That's called Arevus. And interestingly, says the Kli Yakar, one of the famous characteristics of this Tochacha is that there are twice as many curses as there are in the first one. And Parshas Gisava just goes on and on, even if you read it quickly. And therefore, specifically, that means that in Parshas Bechukosai, there are 49 curses, which is still a lot. Those are the seven sevens. Sheva kachatoseichem, the seven sevens. In Parshas Kisav is 98. That's twice as much. Whatever happened that all of a sudden the Tochacha becomes doubled in size? Says the Kli Yakar, it becomes doubled in size because there are now two counts that a person could devolve, either his own wrongdoing, and that used to be all there is to it, or someone that he could have intervened, he could have done something, could have helped them out, could have corrected them, or inspired them in some way. And therefore there's now two counts, so to speak, for Tochacha, and that's why the klolos are doubled. But this is why, says the Kli Yakar, the Torah shifts to Lashon Yachid. Because in this Tochacha, this is the Chiddush of this Tochacha, everyone is as one. Prior to this, in Bechukosai, it's Lashon Rabim, it's almost each man for himself in that sense. But that's exactly what has changed in Bechukosai, where everyone is in it together. And because they're in it together, that's why the Tochacha is written, B'Lashon Yachid. Now, there is a Pasuk, which certainly demands our attention, and that is we're now in Perek Kavches, Pasuk Mem Zayin. Perek Kavches, Pasuk Mem Zayin. And what does the Pasuk say? Tachas, we're in the middle of the klolos here, and it's just getting worse and worse. And then the Torah breaks, actually, and says, you know why this is happening? Because. Tachas asher lo avadata es Hashem Elokecha besimcha ubetuv levav meirov kol. Because you didn't serve Hashem with joy and with a good heart, with an abundance of everything. And moreover, pasuk mem cheses avadata es evecha. So you didn't serve Hashem right, so then you'll serve other people. That's almost like a mida keneged mida. It's an amazing, almost like interruption between the klolos one after the other, and it stops and says, this is happening for this reason. But the question that we need to ask is, it's a fair question, how can such a calamity be the response to what seems to be, at the end of the day, not the worst thing in the world? As if to say, and it maybe depends who you ask, but the simple reading of the pasuk sounds like the Jewish people, when these things happen to them, they're doing mitzvahs. They're just not doing them besimcha, uvetuv leivav. Now, there's no disputing that joy that accompanies the mitzvah. It's a hidur mitzvah. It's okay. We must concede they're not doing mitzvahs in the best possible way. But that's a far cry from that they're doing something wrong. That they already seem to be eligible for these terrible things. Nah. How does in a sense, the punishment fit the crime? That's the question. Again, to summarize, it seems that the Jewish people in this situation are oved es Hashem. Just not besimcha, but tov levav. Okay, it's not good. It's not the best. It doesn't sound so terrible. But the truth of the matter is that it's important to look again at this pasuk to see if the way that we have read it is the way it must be read. We have to watch carefully. Again, the words are tachas because asher lo avadata es Hashem lekecha, you didn't serve Hashem, besimcha ubetuv levav merov kol, enjoy. Now, we have translated that all of this is qualifying the way that you didn't serve Hashem. You didn't serve Hashem in the following way, besimcha ubetuv levav. However, Meshech Chochma says something else. Actually, tachas asher lo avadata es Hashem lekecha, that's it. We're not describing the Jewish people who are not serving Hashem with joy. We're describing the Jewish people who are not serving Hashem at all. Now, the final words of the pasuk, "Besimcha ubetuv levav merov kol," they're not the way in which they're not serving Hashem. They are the reason why they're not serving Hashem. The problem is "Asher lo avadata es Hashem Elokecha." That's the problem. And how did that come about? The answer is it came about from a state which is called besimcha ubetuv levav merov kol, in a state of joy. Now, if we state that, what we seem to have so far, it seems that when the Jewish people are happy, so then they're not serving Hashem. But there's much more to it than that. You see, why should being happy lead a person not to serve Hashem? It's deeper. The pasuk mentions two things. The final part of the pasuk, besimcha v'tuv levav, with joy and a good heart, meirov kol, from an abundance of everything, meirov kol. How do these terms go together? We normally put them together. Simcha, tuv levav, meirov kol. How do they go together? Simcha and tuv levav is an emotional state. Rov kol is a question of how much you have, and that is exactly the question. What the pasuk here is addressing, says Meshech Chochma, is what makes a person happy. And moreover, when do you have everything? And moreover, what is the connection between those two things? What is the connection between being happy and having everything? As if to say, which leads to which? Does being happy give you everything, or does having everything make you happy? That is the question. What the wrong turn that is taken by the Jewish people as described in this pasuk is they come to believe that they will only be happy if they have everything. And the question is, when do you have everything? The answer is never, or not yet. So then the follow-up question is, well, what do you need to do? The answer is to keep going in my attainment of everything, because then I'll be happy and not before. And I want to be happy, and the only way I'll be happy is everything, but to get everything, I need to give my all into getting everything. What about Avodas Hashem? I don't have time. Or I just can't. I'm trying to be happy. It takes up all my time trying to be happy. Because I'll never be happy until I have everything, and I'll never have everything until my life is over. And in the meanwhile, that's what I look like. In other words, these two phrases, Besimcha of Betuv Levav, Meirov Kol. Here's the warped perspective. Happiness and a good heart, it comes from having everything. That's a mistake. And that can lead a person away from any good venture, and certainly from Avodas Hashem. He just doesn't have the energy for it. He's too absorbed and engrossed in getting everything. But the truth is, where's the mistake? The mistake is, he'll never be happy if he makes happiness contingent on having everything, because he'll never have everything. But the tragedy is, aside from the tochacha, the tragedy is, that's such a basic error, because the truth is, it's reversed. Ezu asher samech b'chelko. Say ulamad, that it's tried and tested. The happy people in the world are people who are happy with what they have. People who are not happy with what they have are never happy. And therefore, that's really the tragedy in the pasuk. The relationship between having everything and being happy has been catastrophically reversed. The person comes to believe he will only be happy when he has everything, which will never happen. But the truth is, he will only have everything when he's happy. When you're happy, you have everything. You have everything you need, and that's everything you need. If a person's perspective was, Rov Kol comes misimcha umitub levav, he's got it, and he can free himself up for more meaningful pursuits. The problem begins when those wires get crossed. Everything gets reversed, and now Rov Kol, having everything, doesn't come from being happy. Being happy comes from having everything. It's never going to happen, says Meshach. So that is such a profound insight, and once again, in terms of the parshanut, the criticism of the Jewish people here is not that they're doing mitzvahs without joy. They're not doing mitzvahs because they're in pursuit of joy in a way that is fated to fail. Having said that, then with this we'll conclude, the Rambam does already have seemed to have taken the pasuk the way we originally read it, that we are talking about people who are doing mitzvahs, but just not with simcha. And again, we innocently ask, or fairly ask, what's so wrong with that? The words of the Rambam in Hilchos Luluf, the very end, almost. Well, the final halacha in Perek Ches Pasuk Tesvav. These are his words, briefly. Hasimcha sheyismach adam ba'asiyas ha-mitzvah. The joy that a person experiences when doing a mitzvah, uva'ava sakel shetziva b'hem, and out of love for Hashem who commanded them, avoda gedolahi. It's a great form of avoda. In other words, according to the Rambam, this isn't the icing on the cake of his avoda. The joy in doing a mitzvah is its own avoda. V'cholamoneya atzmei misimchazo. And if a person withholds himself from this joy, ro'oili par mimenu, he deserves to be punished. Shene'emar, and Rambam quotes our pasuk. It's in the heart of Mishneh Torah, in halachas of Lulu. That's how it comes out. Simcha space l'shoeva, simcha. Shene'emar tachas ashelo avadotes Hashem elokecha b'simcha v'tuv leivav. So we see from the Rambam the way he has quoted our pasuk and very clearly explained what it means to say is a person who does mitzvahs but is lacking in simcha, that's a terrible situation and bad things could come from it. But again, having noted the Rambam explains the pasuk this way, we once again ask, but why is it so? But as Meforshim explain, it's a simple idea, but it's important to ponder and to express. The difference between a mitzvah done with joy and the mitzvah done in a joyless, lifeless way, it's not just, quote-unquote, lacking in hidur. It's really lacking in an entire appreciation of what a mitzvah is. And that is a serious absence. That's a serious flaw. Because if a person was conscious and appreciative, and what it does for a person, and what it allows for his connection with Hashem, and for the rectification of his soul, and the development of his character, and all of these things in every way. How could he not be happy? He must have switched off from those things. And therefore, for a person to do mitzvah in a dull way, he's not just missing a hidur in the mitzvah. He's kind of missing an orientation as to what mitzvahs are at all. And that is his own type of detachment, because his whole relationship with mitzvahs is now flawed and wrong. And if he's detached, see, he doesn't want to be detached from Hashem. That's not a good place to be. And bad things could happen. And this is what the Rambam is saying. And it's very interesting to consider, just as we're heading towards the season where this really comes to the fore. Because we have Rosh Hashanah and then Yom Kippur, which are, of course, the days of Tshuva. And then we have Sukkot, which is just there. And it's after all this Tshuva, and it's its own thing, obviously, and it's one of the Shalosh Ragalim. But as we've discussed in the past, it is a way of following on from the Yomim Noraim. Why? Because Sukkot is, of course, all about joy and mitzvahs. Everyone's happy on Sukkot. You've got your Sukkot, you've got your Avraminim, Simchas Beis HaShoeva. Everything's good. Everyone does Sukkot right. But that's part of the Tshuva. Because that's reclaiming, in a sense, what mitzvahs are. Because losing sight of that is what leads to what a lot of people need to do tshuva about in the first place. And therefore, certainly it's a timely message. It begins with this pasuk. It's a very very harsh-sounding pasuk. And of course, we don't wish for its fulfillment. But to appreciate why the pasuk would say that gives us perspective, certainly for the season that's coming, and Mitzvah Hashem, for the days beyond. We'll leave it over there for this evening.